Hey, Radio Rothbard fans. The Mises Institute has a new free book for you. Dr. Guido Holzmann's How Inflation Destroys Civilization. Learn how inflation isn't only making us poorer. It's harming our culture, mental well-being, and the moral foundations of civilization itself. Get your free copy today at Mises.org/RothPodFree.
Welcome back to Radio Rothbard. I'm Ryan McMakin, executive editor with the Mises Institute. And with me, of course, is my co-host, Tho Bishop. And we're very fortunate today to have with us Guido Holzmann. And he's one of our senior fellows. If you follow the Mises Institute at all, you're quite familiar with him. He's a professor at the University of Angers in France and, of course, has helped form many of our PhDs who are associated now with the Mises Institute. And he has a new book out that I want to talk about a little bit today. The book is called Abundance, Generosity, and the State, An Inquiry into Economic Principles. Now, this is an important book. It covers topics that are generally ignored in the field of economics. And if you went through an economics program like I did, and if you ever tell people, like I used to have a job where my job title was economist, and you tell people that's what you do, or I tell them now, oh, I edit an economics publication, they always go back to this idea of homo economicus and what they learned in school. If they took one or two economics classes in school, it's all this idea about rational behavior, neoclassical stuff. And it never really touches upon what these people know is very fundamental to the human experience, which are these issues around non-monetary exchanges, where people, they engage in behavior that doesn't have to do with getting an amount of money back in return for performing this deed or act or selling this service. There's this whole economy out there of, as you say, abundance and generosity. And you, with this book, which is a substantial book, attempt to really raise some of these issues about how do we understand this aspect of the economy. And I'm just really interested in this topic overall. And I've just written some short articles in the past, right, with titles like the Homo Economicus Myth and things like that. And we do find, right, in if you delve into Austrian economics, people like Mises, right, they weren't like the stereotypical neoclassical caricature of economics, like people who took one or two economic classes believe in. And he had a much more sophisticated view. And it seems to me that you're building something substantial based on that good foundation. And so I want to ask you a little bit just kind of your own assessment, really, on what is the state of the discipline on this issue of charity, abundance, and what prompted you then to launch your own investigation into these phenomena?
Well, that's a very good question. Well, charity and abundance are treated separately from standard economics. So if we look at the training of young economists such as yourself, more recently, and myself at the time, and everybody today, in the classes on microeconomics and macroeconomics, you never talk about these things and so on. So these are specialized classes that you typically have on the master level. You get specializations, whatever, in the economics of charity or the economics of nonprofits and something like this. So really specialized courses. It's completely separate from the rest. And what they do there is indeed very often to distance themselves from the standard approach in economics, which relies in neoclassical economics very strongly on the Homo economicus hypothesis. So the Homo economicus is a being that tries to maximize monetary profit, right? So not necessarily monetary revenue, but the difference between revenue and cost over time. So Homo economicus, in whatever he does, has this money measuring rod before his eyes, and that's what he tries to maximize. Now this is obviously a fiction because human beings do not act like that. So it's very easy if you want to present your own study program or your own course on the economics of gifts or of philanthropy or whatever by pointing out, well, the Homo economicus does not correspond to what we observe in the real world, because people are very often not interested in money, and fortunately so. It would make family life very stressful if this was the only topic of conversation and the only orientation. Friendship would be virtually impossible, right, if this was the only thing that counted. So obviously it's not the case. Right? So then why has this become so important in mainstream neoclassical economics? And the reason has much to do, I think, with the attempt to introduce mathematical modeling into economics. It's something that rose slowly in the course of the 19th century and then grew very strongly after the publication of Leon Varras's and Stanley Jevons's books in marginalized economics, or elements of pure economics from Varras and theory of political economy from Stanley Jevons in the early 1870s. Now, they did something that the classical economists had not cared for, namely the introduction of mathematical modeling of human behavior. So this was supposed to be the next great step in improving the quality of the science, right? The modeling it after the natural sciences. So how do you model human behavior that is obviously apparently chaotic, may have different orientations and so on? It can be greatly facilitated by introducing the hypothesis that we are dealing only with human beings that are homines economici. All right, so just try to maximize value. And that brings about one of the results that are crucial to do neoclassical economics, namely the model of the perfectly competitive market. In the perfectly competitive market, you have an equality of revenue and cost for all businesses. And not only revenue and cost are equal, but marginal cost and average cost are also equal in the perfectly equilibrium situation. So all, and that means, I mean, let me translate this. What this means is that whatever service you provide to somebody else, it is exactly retributed with an exact corresponding equal value. Right? You receive a good or a service for somebody, well, you pay an equivalent value to that person. That's the significance of the perfectly equilibrium, perfect competition. Right? And so the Homo economicus was, in fact, a tool to get to this point. How can we explain that there's a tendency toward such a situation? Why is this situation important? Well, because it was supposed to epitomize the very meaning of justice. Right. The idea was that in a perfectly competitive market, well, not only get economic efficiency, but this economic efficiency is also morally just and good. Right. So that was the idea behind Varras. And then Varras and others, of course, they say, well, this is a theoretical construct, because in order to get this point, not only do human beings have to be homines economici, but they also need to be omniscient. Sort of, right? So they need to know exactly what has happened or what the situation currently is, what are the different quantities and qualities of goods that exist, but also they need to be able to foresee what's going to happen in the future. Only then do you get to such a situation in which you have a pure and perfect equilibrium. And so that was obviously not always the case. So then you get deviations, and this opened opportunities for government intervention. Right? So if we deviate from this general equilibrium situation, well, then at least we have an idea. We know where we should be, right? And so we can say, yes, people are imperfectly informed about the existing conditions, so maybe the government should step in and provide information about economic conditions. Maybe the government should intervene in the economy in order to prevent that monopolistically large corporations emerge, or labor unions grow too powerful, and so that rather than have a competitive situation, we have monopoly and so on. Right? So it's a mixed bag, but the idea is really it comes from the idea of creating a model of the economy that is perfectly efficient and perfectly just. In order to get there, you needed the Homo economicus hypothesis. And that, of course, right? You're on the wrong track from the outset, because you're, in fact, what you're doing is not to engage in a scientific endeavor. In science, we're trying to describe reality as it is, to explain the causes and the consequences that follow from it, but you're erecting a straw man, and which is your model, and then you're pretending that somehow this is supposed to represent an ideal in comparison to which you can measure the real world, right? So economics has been on a wrong track ever since those days. And one of the victims is not the only one, but one of the victims was the economics of gratuitous goods, so donations, externalities, and so on, which from then on have been separated in a very artificial way from the main corpus of economics. And what I do in my book very much is really to bring this all back into one edifice and show that, well, building on Ludwig von Mises in particular, but also other very good economists such as Frédéric Bastiat and Kenneth Boulding, more recently was a non-Austrian, well, we can show that really reality is one, right? And also our theoretical explanation of both markets and non-market behavior, gratuitous goods and so on, can be articulated under a unified and coherent theoretical edifice. And that's what I do in the book.
And to help our listeners understand why I'm so excited about this project, and I think the timing of it is so great, is that you mentioned how some of these misconceptions have political ramifications in terms of some of the conclusions that might be drawn there. But, you know, we're at a time right now where kind of the discipline of economics, and perhaps for good reason, given the fallacies of the mainstream, is under attack, not only from the left that has always had a kind of hostility to markets, but also from the right that have criticized economics for being so focused on kind of purely materialistic ends. You know, that some of it extends to some of their criticisms of libertarians as being, you know, hyper-rational or disconnected from this seeking of a, you know, goodness and kind of a spiritual dynamic. And, you know, I think your book as, you know, really, you know, as a treatise, as a foundation that can speak to, and obviously within your work broadly, you've addressed the cultural consequences of various economic phenomenon. But I'm very excited for this to help younger scholars help bridge that divide and help, I think, promote why the Misesian approach to economics is so important, so relevant, where so much of the conversation about economics broadly is so sterile in these areas, and that we have something very rich to add to some of these cultural concerns that I think are very predominant in a lot of the political conversations throughout the West generally, and particularly here in America right now.
Thank you very much for this comment. Yeah, indeed, this is something that I had not really anticipated when I set out writing the book, because my focus was more narrow. I mean, let me come briefly back on your question, Ryan, at the beginning. What was the motivation why they started doing this? Well, I'm Catholic, and Pope Benedict the 16th in 2009, he had published this encyclical, Caritas in Veritate, Love in Truth, Charity in Truth, in which he discussed the central importance in human life of the principle of gratuitousness. That's how I called it. And he says, well, the greatest goods that we possess, love, hope, truth, and so on, right? They are not something that we create, that we deliberately choose, but they are given to us. So we don't produce them, we don't choose them, but we receive them, right? And all these things are received. Now, obviously, this also plays a role in the economy, also notably when we think of gifts. But Benedict thought that it should play probably a bigger role, right? So it should just not be limited or as in a closed box, right? Put into this thing. Yeah, sometimes we do some charity, and the rest of the time we are just trying to maximize revenue. What are the ways in which this principle of gratuitousness in material activities can play a greater role, and it should be a greater role? So he raised this question, right? So what's the answer? Now, in 2009, I was busy with various other things, and then I decided, okay, well, but this is a great topic, and I gave a talk on this or two, and then I set a doctoral student to work on this, And so that was the easiest way for me to kind of keep in touch with this and see a bit, okay, where this, is this going? What is the literature? And so on. And the students I had, it was a very interesting case. Of course, we were still friends. And she's a Catholic nun from Africa. Okay. And so she applied and said, well, would like to do a doctorate with me. And she had been preparing to do a doctorate in Germany. So she had studied German and so on, but in her native country, in Benin, they speak French, right? So, but she had been prepared because she had received a scholarship from the Ratzinger Foundation. And so I was supposed to find a German professor. Well, she did, but not in Germany. Right? And somebody pointed her attention to me and said, well, this is a German professor, but he's teaching in France. And so we got in touch, and I would have been reluctant to take somebody who had Marxist economics in her curriculum. So, in fact, her training was not very good preparation. But it was obvious that she was a smart person because she got a scholarship from the Ratzinger Foundation. They don't give them just away. And she had successfully gone through various other steps in her career. She had worked for the Ministry of the Economy and stuff like this. So she started working on the topic, and her English was not very good. So she was limited to talk about the French literature, the German literature, and then produced a very nice dissertation a couple of years later. So it was 2015. Now, clearly, this was the work of a beginner. It was worth a doctorate because nobody had really written on the economics of gratuitous, no? So this was the first work, so it was very justifiable to give a PhD. But it was clear to me that, well, there are lots of things that need to be taken care of, especially while she did not have a good grasp of monetary economics, so she didn't see the ramifications on gratuitous goods and so on. So I said, well, yeah, so this might be a suitable project for my own. And then it so happened that the following year, I was invited here at the Mises Institute to give a Lou Church lecture. And I chose the topic of gratuitous goods, or it's the political economy of gratuitous goods. And in fact, what my book does is just to work out in much more detail the core ideas that I presented in that lecture. Now, it was not so that I knew at the time everything that I would come to know eventually. This was just a starting point. Right? And then 2 years later, I got a sabbatical semester. So I came to the U.S., and that's when I really started working on the book. And it took me 4 more years to finish. So it's been quite a project, right? And then, of course, you learn various things that you didn't know or even imagine at the beginning, right? And most notably, when it comes to what I call in the book the side effect goods, right? In economics, we're having the theory of market externalities, right? So these are non-intended consequences that follow from a human action, and some of them have positive repercussions on other people. These are positive externalities. Some have negative repercussions, negative externalities. Now, in mainstream economics, these externalities are problematic, right? Precisely because they are not remunerated. Right? Keep in mind what I said before about the perfect, pure and perfect equilibrium. In pure and perfect equilibrium, all goods that are provided to other people are remunerated, but also all costs that you occasion to other people, they're also compensated. Right? So when we have externalities, clearly some benefits are non-compensated, and negative externalities, some harm that you create, pollution or whatever, is non-retributed, right? So not compensated. So that's a big problem, right? And things look very different from an Austrian perspective. This I knew, so this was a helpful starting point. Because Mises had explained already in Human Action, and this was subsequently elaborated by other Austrians, such as Walter Block, Hans Hermann Hoppe, and Murray Rothbard, I also believe. And Mises had explained that there is a huge difference between negative externalities and positive externalities. Negative externalities are a matter for the courts. Right? If you create harm for other people in an unintended way, but demonstrable harm, right? And you don't have the right to do this, then the others can either ask that you stop this, and they can enforce their claim in an economy, you know, in a society where the judicial apparatus is functioning with any modicum of efficiency, or they can ask for compensation. Right. So, for example, let's say you are building your house somewhere with no neighbors at all, right? And you're playing music and song, have loud, some loud activities, and somebody's moving there into the neighborhood. But while you were there first, well, then if they're moving there, well, they know that you make all this noise, and so they accept, in fact, that this is part of their environment. So they have no claim on you. But if you move somewhere else, and you start making noise where there was no noise before, well, it's a different scenario. Right? And so this was explained very well by Mises, and especially by Rothbard in a magnificent text on the problems of air pollution in the early 1980s. Right? So it's on the Mises website. So, right? So for the Austrians, negative externalities, yeah, they are a problem, but that problem is likely to disappear as long as protection services or property rights are protected with any modicum of efficiency. On the other hand, positive externalities are a completely different beast. Positive externalities are not wrong at all. Right? I mean, of course, you might try to get compensation for this, but if it's not possible under current conditions, technically you have no, let's say you're playing violin and other people, bystanders, may enjoy your melodies and so on. Well, if there's no way for you to make them pay for your performance, okay, so what? You're still playing for other reasons, because you enjoyed yourself or for your friends who are around you. Well, other people benefit from it as well, so be it. That's just how it is. And in fact, so for me, this is really nothing wrong with this. And this is absolutely crucial to understand one of the most important, most beneficial aspects of a free economy, namely that it's in fact full of such externalities, or positive externalities, or side effects, right? So there is a sort of abundance of goods for which we don't pay, for which we benefit every day in a free society. So this is one thing that I came to understand in the course of my studies, that in fact, in a growing market economy, there is in fact the tendency that the relative importance of such unpaid for goods increases relative to the commercial part of the economy in which you strive for revenue and so on, right? So all economic goods, of course, increase in volume, but the non-paid part, right, the gratuitous part, is likely to increase. And the other way around, if you have impoverishment, then of course the gratuitous part is likely to be hit harder than the commercial aspect, right? So that's a very important point to understand, right? And then when it comes to government intervention, you can demonstrate, and that's what I try in a case in the book, and it's also something that I didn't anticipate at the beginning when I started, but it's very clear that precisely those positive side effects, they are harmed by various government interventions. And one important example is governments have in the past privatized to their own benefit various goods that have existed previously only as a cultural common, that is something that results spontaneously from economic activity or from human activities, but without any deliberate creation. The most important example that's always discussed in the Austrian literature is the monetary system. And if there's no government intervention, well, there would still be a monetary order, right? So people would use a generally accepted medium of exchange, and it would be produced by certain people in various ways, precious metals, maybe Bitcoin, I don't know what, right? So, but people would use this, and everybody would benefit from it, but nobody would really own that order, right? So it's a cultural common. Same thing concerning the judicial order, right? So in the absence of government interventions, well, there would be arbitration services, there would be lawyers, there would be judges, because it's necessary to settle conflicts as peacefully, as cost-efficiently as possible. So people would be doing this. And such an order would exist without being owned by anybody. Right? And it would benefit everybody. So it's something as a spontaneous institution in Karl Menger's works, words. Now, what the government does is to privatize these things. Right? The government takes over and starts to own the order and creates, in fact, a system, a monetary system, a judicial system. Right? And now the system is supposed to benefit the government in various ways, right? And so what in fact happens here is the privatization of all the benefits, well, not all, but a more or less a large part of the benefits that otherwise would spontaneously accrue to all the members of society. And so, and you can show this for other side effect benefits as well.
Well, we've certainly covered a number, I think, points that that show that the mainstream, the neoclassical views and the models that are used are problematic in terms of enlightening us on these topics. What are some of the ways that the Austrian school is uniquely positioned to give you insights on this and providing a good foundation for our analysis of gratuitousness?
Well, element is that, well, the Austrians have never subscribed to the Aristotelian equivalence postulate. That's so the idea. So in Aristotle, well, I personally, well, I mean, I'll say from the outset, right, I'm pretty Aristotelian in my whole approach, right? So for example, if you read chapter 2 of my book, this is Aristotle A to Z. So I'm a Aristotelian realist, right? I would say, but Aristotle has bequeathed us one idea that is just wrong, and he doesn't really demonstrate the idea at all. He just brings it forth in the Nicomachean Ethics, Book 5, in which he discusses the virtue of justice. And Aristotle claims that justice is characterized by an exchange of equal values, right? So whenever you give something and you receive something of equal value in return, that situation is just, right? And the Austrians have never subscribed to this. This is really the founding of the Mengarian theory of subjective value and of the following theory of market prices, that what people give in exchange has for them always a lower value than the thing that they receive. And there's nothing wrong with this. Quite to the contrary, it's perfectly just because all people agree. In fact, when the two people, both of them benefit from this, right? It's not that one is ripped off at the to the benefit of the other one. But if one person gives an apple in exchange for an orange, right, then the apple that he gives is for him of lower value than the orange that he receives. But the point is that for the other person who gives the orange and receives the apple, it's the other way around. He prefers the apple to the orange. So he too benefits. That's in fact the little miracle at the center of market exchange. So it's not an exchange of equal values, but a double win. It's a win-win situation, right? You don't have to arrange this with special policies or special laws or something like this. It's just the condition under which any exchange takes place. Otherwise, nobody would do it. Right. And so the Austrians have never done this. And as a consequence, they didn't care much about constructing a situation or explaining why the market tended toward a situation in which everything that was received was equally retributed by something of equal value. It was of no consequence to them. Right. And so what for the Austrians, what always comes was not that situation in which cost is equal to revenue, but it's the process through which people interact. And it's true, right? If we think this process through, well, there is a tendency toward the disappearance of profits eventually, not toward a situation in which all revenue is equal to cost. That's Austrians do not hold this, right? I mean, not in the sense that marginal cost is equal to average cost. Austrians don't believe this, but they believe that average cost is equal to the average revenue, which is, so is the market price. So that was of no consequence for them, right? And so therefore my theory was not burdened from the outset with that objective, right? There was no point in demonstrating that a pure and perfect competitive situation result from the market process eventually. Another example why Austrians are particularly suited is this the idea that we also find in value theory, namely that different goods satisfy different needs that cannot be reduced to a common denominator. That is also very, very important. It seems to be a technicality. And at the time I had studied this when I was writing the Mises biography, I pointed out that in that respect, there's a big difference between Menger on the one hand And Jevons and Varaz, on the other hand, Jevons and Varaz, they said, well, all goods are have something, one thing in common, that is utility. So in fact, what a maximizing agent does is to maximize the utility that he gets out of different sorts of satisfaction. He can drink a cup of water, he can drink a cup of beer, or whatever, buy some shoes, go on a vacation. And all these different satisfactions, they have one thing in common, namely utility. So what we're really maximizing is, because we can reduce them to a common denominator, we are maximizing utility. Now, the problem with this conception, as I then discovered in my book on gratuitous goods, is that in that story, the maximization concerns one single agent. Right? So there's really nothing there. You place yourself from the outset into a solipsistic situation. There's only this one person that counts, because it's really only his satisfaction or his utility and his choices that are part of the picture. Whereas in Menger, you have, these different goods cannot be reduced, to a common denominator. They are heterogeneous. So what the agent does, in fact, is to make decisions that bring for them in their combination the best result, right? But the different objective that he pursues cannot be reconciled or cannot be reduced to a common denominator. So from that point of view, it becomes possible to conceive, the satisfaction of the needs of others is one of our objectives, right? And it's not on the same level as the satisfaction they are meant for ourselves. So we can make this difference, right? So from the Austrians, we can explain the behavior of somebody who just thinks of himself, who is an egomaniac. Yes, with Austrian theory, you can explain that kind of behavior. But we can also explain why somebody would just care predominantly or partially for others. And so he sets aside some of his time, some of his resources to cater to the needs of other people, all for a deserving cause, right? He's pursuing justice for his own sake. He doesn't look at the bottom line for himself, but he says, I want to pursue justice for justice's sake, and I don't care what it costs to me, right? We cannot care at all. It's probably difficult, but he is willing to sacrifice a substantial amount of his time and of his resources in the pursuit of this goal. So from the Austrian, in the context of Austrian economics, it becomes possible, it's much richer, right? It's much richer in the possibilities to conceptualize, to understand these different activities and distinguish them.
Well, we've touched upon a little bit on where things went wrong in terms of, right, they've got these models and they want to quantify things. And I do think that continues to be part of the issue just on a very fundamental level, in the sense that when you start talking to people about, not everybody does things for monetary gain. And you say, they might just like giving gifts away. You see this all the time, right? Oh, I want my work-life balance. I prefer leisure to actually having money for a variety of reasons. And there seems to be, when you start talking to some people about this, there seems to be a resistance to really engaging that idea. And I think a lot of it comes down to, it just can't be measured. It's hard to measure. I prefer leisure. Why do you prefer leisure? I don't know. I like skiing. How much do you like? How many utils does skiing give you? And you start getting into very complex and non-precise measurements of things, right? And I had asked you in an earlier Q&A on this, I said, because I was anticipating the question that people would ask, always the cynics, or if you talk to a philosophy undergrad, they'll always come back with, they're people, they don't do anything really out of charity. They always think that there's always some hidden motivation. The cynic will tell us that they really are angling for some gain. So I asked you, right, do pure gifts really exist? And you came back and you said, actually, it's really hard to know inside people's minds whether they intend to give a pure gift or not. It's immeasurable. So then I thought, maybe the real question is, do pure gifts really exist? And if we can't observe that, does it matter if pure gifts really exist? Do we need to concern ourselves with this issue of whether people are having pure motives in terms of their charity, or is that just irrelevant to our economic analysis?
No, it's a good question, right? And in much of economic research, based on what you described, this hypothesis that there's always some reciprocity that is being sought after, right, or whatever we do, has been underlying economic research in the emergence of institutions and so on. And the conclusion of all of this research, theoretical research but also empirical, is, you cannot explain why certain institutions exist, why people behave peacefully and stuff like this. So all you end up with is ultimately, people will always be trying to gain political power in order to enrich themselves. Right? And so therefore, we need to have some deus ex machina, right? Some solution that comes from outside of the system and that creates a solution. Therefore, that's why people end up in saying, we need to have a state who creates the judicial apparatus, who creates the monetary system for this all to work out. Right? So my answer is that, yes, we can very well explain that such institutions like the juridical order, the monetary order, without any government interventions, evolve if there are people in society that are willing to make the necessary sacrifices. And that's, of course, it's not an original hypothesis or thesis or something. It's, in fact, what most people have believed coming from philosophy and theology and so on, that, in fact, human society is built on sacrifice, ultimately. It's not built on the calculus of pleasure and pain, but on the willingness on the side of at least some people, and these are the leaders, to make the necessary sacrifices for the sake of the greater good. And that's how society, in fact, thrives. It thrives at the expense of sacrifice. It's a very, very powerful result. And of course, it's in tune with what we believe as Christians. And that's, I think, it goes a long way to explaining why modern civilization, widespread market exchange among people who barely know each other and so on, has emerged in the Western Hemisphere. And of course, we do a lot currently to destroy all of this, so we'll see how far it goes. And I shouldn't be surprised if we experience brutal and sudden collapses, right? Because if there's nobody there anymore who is willing to make sacrifices and he sees the beauty of it and is willing to forego benefits for himself so that other people, his family, of course, in the first place, but other people at large, humanity, thrive, then we won't go very, very far.
Yeah, so it's really interesting when you start to get into especially ways of life that are not considered normal by the modern mind. For example, there's an abbey a couple hours from my house. I go up there, a Benedictine abbey. I go up there every now and then for retreat purposes and that sort of thing. So there's these nuns that live there. And they come from the same background as me, some of them. They're similar age in many cases. They're from the suburbs. And at some point they decided, I want to live in this abbey for the rest of my life, right? And I had a discussion with one of them talking about how even a regular practicing religious person like you or me, a lot of people, they don't understand why you would do these things on a daily basis or regular. What's the payoff, right? Yeah. It's all the more bizarre to encounter one of these nuns who wears this habit and prays multiple times per day and the formalistic psalmody and all of this stuff. I mean, how do you even begin to explain that stuff using neoclassical economics? It's just totally out there.
Yeah, it's folly, right? It's the only explanation. Yeah, and what Christians have always held, and the great Christian social philosophers of the Middle Ages and the present as well. I mean, all our civilization springs from that, from such folly, right? Folly in the eyes of humans. But in fact, you can demonstrate, yes, I mean, it's not something that is intended, because if it were intended, it would no longer be a sacrifice, right? It's not something that is the purpose. I mean, if the nuns consecrate their lives to prayer and contemplation of God and of creation, it's not in order to save civilization. That's not the objective. It's not a means deployed in order to attain that end, but it's still something that follows from it.
Well, I mean, all I can do is recommend to our listeners that they pick up a copy of the book. You can get it soon. It's not quite widely available, I don't believe, but soon you should be able to get it on Amazon.
It's already on Amazon.
Is it on there now? Yeah, okay. Yeah. Well, then go ahead.
But the prices are lower on the Mises website,
yes,
as I noticed.
I was going to say, you should definitely go to the Mises bookstore, and you can get a copy there. And this is certainly a brand new book. And yeah, I can't recommend it enough.
And before we get out of here, obviously we're here recording at AERC. We have a number of your students that are presenting papers. And obviously the Holzman branch of the Austrian School is thriving. Can you just talk for our listeners where you see the current, where is the Austrian tradition right now? What are some of the projects out there that you find particularly interesting, and what's your experience with the students that you have reaching out to you as you know, one of the preeminent scholars out there with a number of PhDs? Mm-hmm. You know, we have a lot of stress out there, and you know, politically and culturally and that sort of stuff. But there is a lot of hope, I think, within the talent and in the minds that are seeking answers in these times. Can you just talk a little bit about that perspective as?
Thank you very much. In my approach to doctoral training, I don't have really an agenda. I don't have a research program in which I want to integrate everybody. I want everybody to work on a subject that he really loves, for which he is interested, and just help them in that research. And I think it's also good to for all of them to become interested in the work of others. So we are regularly meeting, and then everybody's supposed to read the work always of all the others and comment on the work of all us, because there's some technical aspects in conducting research that are the same whatever the topic you're working on, right? So relating to methodology of the critique and so on. So they're working on very different topics. Last fall, I had three guys who graduated. Two Americans, actually, Jeffrey Degner from Cornerstone University and Peter Earle from the American Institute of Economic Research. Degner, he was working on the family in the inflation culture, and Degner was working on the accuracy of financial risk metrics. Okay, so very different topics, somewhat related to finance and money and so on, but really quite different things. So they've benefited from the fact that others were working on something else, right? And so they were obliged to comment on this also. Very often you get inspiration by, consecrating, giving, right, a part of your time to something that is not immediate concern to yourself. The great Mises, he always said, in his own readings, he was very, he had very often a random selection of things they would read. He didn't pack all the books related, let's say, to the theory of value on a stack. Now I'm working through to the bottom. So, he was reading one or two books on this and then hopping off to something else, because very often inspiration and fruitful hypothesis come from reading something that's not directly related to this. And so that's a bit the culture that I try to cultivate in my doctoral seminar. Let me just mention the third doctoral student who graduated was Philip Reis. He's a Dutch man. He's also teaching at a small Christian college in the Netherlands. And I won't mention the new guys coming up, because I don't want to put any pressure on them. Because sometimes also people, it doesn't happen very often with me, but sometimes people drop out because there are other things that become more important in their lives. Or they just go frustrated. The sacrifice of time becomes too important, because there is a lot of sacrifice that you need to make in order to produce anything of value in research, right? So that's a bit my approach, right? It's not really a program or some grand vision of what are the topics that need to be addressed. I don't look at current policies in order to pick the suitable topics, but I do look at great problems, great transformations, and so on. And then, depending on the person that is involved, well, some topics are suitable for this and that person. For example, Peter Early was working on the accuracy of financial risks. He was the perfect person to do it, because he had worked 20 years on Wall Street. He was very quick on his feet in quantitative methods and so on. He was just a good person to work on this.
All right. Well, thank you, Professor Holzman, for joining us today. We'll go ahead and wrap up with that for this episode of Radio Rothbard. Thank you, Tho. And, well, we'll be back next week with a new episode. So we'll see you next time.